Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, 11 minutes after 9 o'clock. We start off our show with an open discussion of issues in the news and beyond. We call it, wait for it, a Roundtable on the Roundtable. Mm-hmm. Clever. Mm-hmm. Okay. Joining me for the discussion today, WAMC's Alan Shartok, WAMC's Morning Edition host, David Gustina, and Associate Editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain. Morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. You can join us by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page. You can go to tweet us, if you wish, at WAMC Roundtable. All of those options are yours if you want to join the conversation. And we'll start today with, you want to start with the letter?
All right, go
with the letter. This is based on Vox Pop from yesterday.
We discussed a Hail Mary pass, if you will remember.
Oh, yes.
That. Yeah. And here comes the letter from Lucian Miller.
Okay.
Alan, spelled wrong, had it only half right on your informative Hello Baseball show. The rest of you were way off. No, Hail Mary does not originate with Notre Dame. Harumph! It's from the prayer, for heaven's sake, to Mary, the mother of Jesus and mother of God, called by billions through the ages the Hail Mary. Oh, for your information, here it is.
Are you going to do it now?
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God,
pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Okay. It originated from Scriptures 128, Hail Mary, full of grace. Okay, we did that already.
We indeed.
Okay. Male athletes don't pray, Our Father who art in heaven, when they are desperate. They pray, Hail Mary.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, well, we do all these things.
Nor do female athletes, nor fathers, nor mothers, or sons, or daughters, or grandparents, or grandchildren when they can't see straight. They pray Hail Mary. Why? Men need the feminine, don't you know? Girls need the supermom, too. Is she some sort of divine guruette, god or goddess? No way, Jose. We pray Hail Mary because Mary is it, powerful, holy woman, the virgin Jewish mother of Jesus, the Savior, and mother of God, and on and on and on. Uh-huh. So so I wrote back and said, don't you guys do this thing? And I said, in my synagogue, they don't give out Hail Marys,
right,
as a penance. Mm-hmm. And then you wrote something even longer, didn't you?
Well, the show's over, everyone. Yeah,
thanks for being here. Yeah, this has been fabulous.
Well, anyway. That was fun.
But you wrote in defense of yourself.
But I may have been ordered to say a few dozen in my time.
Yes.
Yes.
And so, and you also said that you mentioned the prayer, the Hail Mary.
We sure did. Yeah, absolutely.
Yesterday.
Yeah, so, obviously. I thought it was self-evident, but apparently not.
It sort of negated the letter.
Anyway, this is the round. That was Vox Pop. This is the Roundtable. And the great headline on the Times Union today, Mike Spain of the Times Union.
Did you
Malcolm
write that?
In no. the middle. And this is a huge story. A bipartisan series of arrests yesterday, 3 Democrats, 3 Republicans. Mike, first tell us what you know, and then we'll hand it over to Alan, and we'll start talking about the political ramifications of same.
Well, you know, I know what everybody has been reading, and that there's a continuing, ongoing series of corruption arrests that have been happening with state lawmakers. You know, this is just the latest. In fact, the U.S. Attorney for New York, Preet Bharara, used the metaphor of the Groundhog Day, which Casey Seiler pointed out yesterday, our state editor, that he used that already. So he's even repeating the Groundhog Day metaphor. In other words, there just seems to be a continuing cycle. There seems to be no end. Today on our front page, along with the story that Jimmy Vielkind wrote that kind of sums it all up, and reports about, how Malcolm Smith, who was briefly the state Senate majority leader back in 2009 before the coup and is part of the Independent Democratic Coalition now, or was until
today,
until he was
stripped
sometime yesterday, was indicted in this, this scheme to buy off the support of New York City borough Republican leader so that he could run for mayor while remaining a Democrat but run as a Republican, I guess, in New York City.
You need 3 out of 5
you need
borough presidents.
David, tell them.
What's the law called?
You need a Wilson Pakula.
You need Wilson. Yes, exactly it's right. Wilson,
you know, I've been a political scientist studying state politics for 1,000 years, and I can only tell you that one of those things that keeps running through my mind again and again and again, as you guys did the Hail Mary, to me, it's Wilson Pakula, Wilson Pakula, Wilson Pakula.
I don't think we can quote that.
And you know, Stacy Perry Rosenberry is our wonderful engineer here, and that's another thing that keeps going through my mind.
She's not, well, it has nothing to do with Wilson Pakula.
No, not really.
No, just Stacy Perry Rosenberry. It's one of those names. Now, Wilson
Pakula, was that Malcolm Wilson?
It was.
Correct. Another Malcolm.
In the middle. That's right. And by the
way, Irwin Pakula.
Irwin Pakula. Just in case you think you're so
clever.
Smart.
Everybody.
Every newspaper had Malcolm in the middle.
It was hard to avoid.
Yeah.
Well, I like it anyway. And I saw it in the Times Union, so I'm giving them the credit.
We had it online yesterday.
You did. Quickly in the wonderful
when
log.
I was here, I said it, Malcolm in
all
the middle.
Right,
everybody knows Malcolm in the middle.
We are also run today a rogues gallery of corruption cases. And it was so long, we had to continue it inside. There wasn't enough room on the front page to put the pictures of all the recently indicted or convicted state lawmakers. We could go through them if you like, but we might not have enough time.
We could make a game show out of it, I think.
Whatever.
Yeah, you know, all right, so this boils down to a real estate developer, as I can see it, who wanted a few hundred yards of road.
Tract of land. Okay. He wanted an improvement of some roadways so he could develop some land off that roadway.
So Smith needed 3 out of 5...
Republican leaders to have a Wilson Pakula
to get on the mayoral ballot as on the Republican line.
Get a certificate.
Wilson Pakula. Then wears a wire, and all of this is recorded.
That's right.
This undercover agent.
He was patted down first, right, David?
At some point, he was patted down by one of the accused, and seemed to clear the pat down. And I believe it was Barrara who said he was good at the pat down, good at the shakedown, not the pat down.
Okay, so go ahead, Raymond.
Well, and so, interestingly, New York City Councilman Dan Halloran involved in this somehow.
The only elected Republican in New York City.
And so he is also on tape, and I'm sure it's in the Times Union. I have it from the New York Times. He says on tape, money is what greases the wheels, good, bad, or indifferent. And so apparently the complaint says he was given $7,500 in cash, too, so into the pokey he goes, along with the mayor of Spring Valley.
Deputy mayor of Spring Valley. Both.
Is this, Mike, the tip of the iceberg? Is there more to this? Will there be more arrests, or have we seen it?
Well, that would be asking me to predict the future. Is there more corruption?
That's what we're here for.
Is there still more corruption going on in state government that may be uncovered? You have an aggressive U.S. attorney in New York going after it. What do you think?
I predict.
Here we go. Hang on, get the sounder.
I predict a lot of guys didn't sleep last night because, you know, money does grease the thing. And here's the beauty of the whole thing. We really don't know where that line is. Let's take the wonderful, I think he's a wonderful mayor of New York. But when he wants something, money gets spread all around the place. But it gets spread legally.
Legally? It's his own. He opens up his pocket and writes it.
Yeah, he spreads it legally. Yeah. So money is. He was right. Money is what makes it all go round.
That could be the defense, you know, for Halloran. You know, I was just speaking facts. Money is what greases the wheels. It's the truth.
Well, we know it. That's why this is going to be a great thing, a great push for campaign finance. And we're going to have John Soros on Monday, I believe, talking about the need for campaign finance in our state.
Public financing of campaigns.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. That really makes it sound much better.
I'll tell you what we'll do. We're here with Mike Spain, Associate Editor of the Times Union, WAMC's Alan Chartok, and David Gustina. I'm Ray Graffin for Joe Donahue. Tell you what, Mr. Hopper at the controls, let's take a short break, and then I want to get back and talk to Alan and Mike and Dave, if he wishes to chime in, about what this means if Malcolm Smith goes down, what it means for the balance of power in the Senate, and ultimately Governor Cuomo. Let's take a break. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. It's The Roundtable on WAMC. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, 21 minutes after 9 o'clock. Remember, you can email us at roundtable@wamc.org if you want to chime in this morning, or you can comment on our webpage, wamc.org, or our Facebook page, or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. Now, the Facebook page is facebook.com/WAMC Radio, and we will get your comments, and if there's time, we'll get them on the air here. So we talked about sort of the mechanics of what happened yesterday with State Senator Malcolm Smith being arrested along with New York City Councilman Dan Halloran and the mayor of Spring Valley and the deputy mayor of Spring Valley. So, Alan, the power is so tenuous, the balance of power in the Senate, assuming, and it's a huge assumption, that he may get off scot-free. It's happened before. But if he ends up losing his seat in the Senate, then where does that put things? And what does Governor Cuomo think about that?
Well, not at all. Doesn't affect anything. Here's what's happened. Ray, it was a very good question. I want to compliment you on it. And I'll take you to lunch. It'll be my tweet. But think about this. There were four of them that went over to the other side, but they were all white. It was white, four white guys. And then there was, the leadership of the state Senate among the regular Democrats were people of color or others who were not traditional, white guys. So Malcolm Smith became a very important addition to their group because he's black. But it doesn't mean anything. I mean, the coup was already happened. The key person here is Andrew Cuomo, because Andrew Cuomo, I know, whether anybody else knows it or not, and I think everybody does, likes having the Republicans somewhat in charge, so it slows things down. Otherwise, he's going to have the state Senate in Democratic hands. He's going to have the Assembly in Democratic hands. They're going to spend everybody out of house and home, and he likes having this drag. We know this because he said when he was running for office, I've said it 1,000 times, that he was going to not sign any reapportionment bill that allowed them to draw their own districts. The Republicans in the Senate and the Democrats in the Assembly. He didn't do what he said he was going to do, which was tipping his hand that he wanted the Republicans in charge. Now he brings over these four guys. The day that Andrew Cuomo...
He brought them over?
Well, that's a very good question. we can only surmise that he didn't object.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell you one thing. The day that Andrew Cuomo brings the state Senate Democrats, all of them, into a room with the four dissident Democrats, Jeff Klein, etc., and says to them, boys, play nice. You're all Democrats. We're going to do it this way. The Democrats are in charge in New York State from now on. The Republicans, because it's too blue a state, it's never going to happen. So, it's a long-winded explanation, Ray, but the truth of the matter is that Malcolm Smith means nothing other than giving a certain kind of legitimacy to this conference, this independent conference, because he's of color.
Okay, and we can follow this here at WAMC. We'll have the latest for you. Mike Spain is here from the Times Union. Their political blog is must reading. If you get a chance in the morning, it's a good read. There's often a hilarious moment or two.
Did you say Musk? Musk reading?
Capital Confidential is the name of the
Capital
blog.
Confidential, and Jimmy and all your Capital reporters are on there, and it's really quite terrific. All right, let's shift gears here on the roundtable as we are wont to do on this hour-long segment. Background checks still a stumbling block in the House and the Senate, and President Obama still forging ahead with what he sees as very important legislation. Assault weapon ban looks like it's dead nationally anyway for now. Now it comes down to background checks. The president making a PR run, if you will, to Colorado, next week to Connecticut to push for these. Wayne LaPierre and many Republicans in the House are saying, well, now hold the phone here. This is just going, the next time there is a tragic incident, they're going to use this list. They're going to come and take your guns. So where does this go, Mike Spain?
Well, the interesting thing is that the NRA unveiled their own 250-page plan yesterday to do what they said was a good idea in the wake of the Newtown tragedy, and that is to put an armed school official in every school around the country. And they have this plan, and they've got Asa Hutchinson heading it to implement this and begin training programs. They'll have up to 60 hours of training available for whoever's designated for whichever school. And, after the tragedy at Newtown, the NRA said that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is to have a good guy with a gun. And so they're being preemptive. They're getting out in front of this. The odd thing is that back in 1999, Wayne LaPierre was actually okay with some kind of expanded background checks. But now they're not. They've become hardened in their positions. It seems like they don't want to give up anything, because to give up anything will perhaps open the door to more erosion of what they regard as these essential Second Amendment rights. The way the White House portrays it, you have some background checks now that have been successful in stopping the sale of firearms to more than a couple million people over the years.
Right.
But then you have all these alternate ways to acquire weapons, and those are online or at gun shows where they don't do background checks, and all they want to do is close that gap. They liken it to going through the airport, and you have this line where you're going through the security and you're taking off your belt and they're looking in your bags. And then you have another line where nobody's even being touched and going right through. And they're really just trying to close that gap, having given up on an assault weapons ban, at least at this time. It just had no chance of survival.
But Mike, didn't they put air marshals on? I don't want to argue for the NRA. Certainly. But didn't they put air marshals on many of these flights for exactly the same reasons?
Well, there are schools. There are schools in the country that have armed guards, and that's one of the things the NRA points out. They say it's been successful. One of the problems is, what do you do? Do you also want to start putting armed guards in movie theaters because we had a killing in Colorado, or do you want to start putting armed guards
in all the
slippery shopping
slope.
Centers? And, it certainly may be practical to do it in certain dangerous places, but do we want to automatically assume that every school is a dangerous place and that it's going to require this? It's going to need armed guards. Well, that's their way to sort of blow smoke while they're opposing and leaning on maybe some senators who are in swing states. The Republicans are close to taking over the U.S. Senate in the next election, and if there's some vulnerable senators in some moderate states where if they vote for this expansion of background checks, they might be vulnerable to defeat.
They will be.
Yeah.
We saw what happened to Andrew Cuomo. He was fine until he took on the gun interests.
His numbers are still fairly high.
Well, they're still
right, but
he
did spend some of his considerable political capital
and
to
I
do
thought,
it.
Yeah. It's one of the first things he did that I really said took some courage.
Right, and he had it to spend, and he spent it, and now he's more like the rest of us. His numbers are...
What about the Senate and the filibuster? What if that happens?
Well, I have a feeling that this is very important to a lot of people. So you get 300 million guns is the estimate in the United States.
Yeah.
And gun owners think of their guns as being really important to them, so salient that becomes an issue that they are willing to vote politicians in or out on. We saw the same thing in gay rights, right, Mike, here in New York. It was the right thing to do. They did it. There were profiles in Courage, a couple of senators. They lost their seats as a result of it. And they are fully aware that they can lose their seats over this, too.
But ultimately, this heads to the House and it dies anyway, right?
Well, I think it's a statement that if the Senate is able to pass it, there'll be enormous pressure on congressmen to go along with it. You have the $12 million ad campaign by Michael Bloomberg, all things go around.
And there's lots more where that came from.
And there'll be others.
Yes, there is.
Well, some people said after Sandy Hook what the anti-gun movement needed was something like Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Sure. All right, let's pick this up on the other side of the news. You're listening to The Roundtable on The Roundtable on The Roundtable on The Roundtable. Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Time is 9:36. We're joined this morning by WAMC's Alan Chartok, our morning edition host Dave Gustina, and associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain. It's the first hour of the show. We call this Roundtable on The Roundtable. You can join us by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org or comment on our webpage or Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Before we hit the news, we were in a discussion about the national legislation and President Obama's push to get a background check in place for guns. The assault weapon ban appears to be DOA at this point. However, background checks still very much in play on Capitol Hill. And Dave, you know, the local angle is Connecticut, yeah. and big news there.
Well, and, you know, as they seek to pass the what would be some of the toughest in the nation gun control laws in Connecticut, and we're hearing that the Senate will take it up at 10:30, followed by the Senate, and then the governor, Malloy, has said he will sign it. But some of the unintended consequences, and Alan and Mike, if you want to share your thoughts on this, but we see even in New York, when we passed the Safe New York Gun Law, that there was a rush to these gun shops by people, and a report on the wires in Connecticut this morning that people are lining up to get guns.
Well, that's because once the bill is signed, the it'll take effect, and parts of it will take effect. Registration of magazines will take place in 2014 on January 1st, but there will be an immediate impact, and the ability to buy certain firearms will be restricted. So that's why there's a rush. That happened in New York. That's one of the rationales for Governor Cuomo doing the controversial waiving of the three-day waiting period.
Right.
You know, and he rushed it through. And he's taken a lot of heat for that, but that was what was happening here. We were all, you know, all the media was reporting, you know, gun shops in the Capital Region, lines outside, people trying to get their hands on AR-14s or AR-15s, wow. Et cetera. And because it's going to take effect right away, it's a boom town for the gun shops.
And in the background here, David and Mike and Ray too, there is the idea we heard on NPR yesterday that Connecticut is a gun manufacturing state,
mm-hmm. yeah.
gun manufacturing state, and we had people literally talking into the microphones and saying, "Don't take my livelihood away. My children are depending on this." So on the one hand, you have people who are saying, you know, guns are killing a lot of people. You got to get the guns. It's my position, by the way. You got to get the guns off the street and all the rest of it. And then you have people saying, hey, that may be true, but, you know, don't take my job away.
And at least three states in our region, Connecticut, Massachusetts with Smith & Wesson, yeah. and Remington in Illion, in New York, all three states have gun manufacturers.
You know, one of the aspects of the lines that you're seeing in Connecticut and the lines that have been in New York is strictly capitalistic. In other words, I was out last month having a couple cigars at a cigar lounge with several gun owners, registered, responsible, upstanding people, high in the community. And they were complaining about the fact that the prices have gone through the roof because of what is going on and the fear of more of what is going on. So these guys say, well, gosh, you know, I'm going to go to the range, but I'm not going to use X, Y, and Z because that ammunition cost me so much. I'm not just going to plink some targets with this thing. I'm just going to hold on to it.
Sure.
So in other words, the prices are a real problem. And so what you may be seeing is a Black Friday effect in Connecticut as well. People saying, look, it's going to cost me four times as much.
I better get it now.
But you said something just now that piqued my interest. Isn't it true that cigars and cigarettes kill more people than guns do?
Yeah, and I'm sure you would outlaw all that as well.
I would.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's another discussion, but thanks for grinding things to a halt here. Let's let's move on to another topic, and this was in the Times Union, among many other places. But the Capital Region, among the nation's least religious, and also I should mention that Burlington, Vermont is the least.
Well, this is a Gallup poll, and a lot of these polls are in the question.
The Gallup poll is the best Republican poll you can find.
Okay, fine.
We're following the election returns, right. You mean?
Okay. But the Times Union ranks on the top 10 of areas in the country where people reported, you know, the lowest number of people reported that they don't feel very religious. Isn't that the right way to put it? It doesn't mean that they're not moderately religious. If you take the very religious and the moderately religious of the people that replied to the Gallup survey, the Capital Region does pretty well.
They say their Hail Mary before the football game.
They do. Shall we say it again?
No, let's loop it around to the beginning of the program. Thank you.
But our story today by by Paul Nelson talks to somebody from the Capital Area Council of Churches, and she was saying that this isn't really that big a surprise. And there's another interesting aspect of the way it was asked. Protestant chaplain at Union College in Schenectady, Victoria Brooks, said, you know, if they asked people if they're spiritual, they probably would have gotten a much higher response.
Yeah.
And you know, what one person's very religious is another person's moderately religious. People don't necessarily wear it externally here, but there's a lot of impact of faith in the community. There's a lot of churches and synagogues and faith communities that do enormously good things for our local community. They run shelters and they do good works for the poor, and they, you know, so I don't know. It's all in the question. I think this is a fairly
but
good
why,
area.
Mike? I mean, does it say why this area in particular? Does it try to explain that?
I think it's just how people perceive it, and I think how it's asked. You know, what's number one on the list of people who regard themselves as very religious is Provo, Utah, which is a dry county in Utah that is home to Brigham Young University.
Right.
And, you know, and then the rest of them are all Bible Belt states. You know, it's a part of the culture to regard yourself as very religious. And I don't think it's so much a part of the culture in the Northeast. You know, it's the New England is a place where religious tolerance and religious freedom really had its roots in the beginning of the country. So people don't, you know, they're accepting of other people's faiths.
Yeah.
So they don't want to, you know, force their own faith down the throat of their neighbor. And so they're subtle about it. I think they're affected by it. I think it has a very positive impact on the people. But I don't, and I think this article kind of bears that out. I think it's more in the way the question was asked. It's just one of those surveys.
Yeah, the question might be asked, do you go to church every week?
Well, that's part of it. Yeah. That's actually part of it.
Is where you get the real fall off.
And I would suggest that there's people who go frequently and regard themselves as very religious, and people who go frequently and regard themselves as moderately religious, and
or people who don't go and consider themselves, as you say, spiritual and religious.
Yes, and
there are no atheists in foxholes.
Right, no atheists in foxholes.
Or as my father once said, I'm hedging my bets.
Yeah. Well, I think the Lord would know, right?
Well.
Well,
there.
Okay. So then this is really kind of a non-story, then.
Well, you know, it generates some good conversation.
Well, was it in the newspaper?
I think it generates some good conversation. It's a topic that you know, people talk about, and you know,
not including here.
We want to, when we pick stories for the front page of the paper, it's to kind of tap into the community conversation and kind of set the agenda for conversation.
Right.
So here we are talking about it.
You're very powerful.
You're very powerful. The great and powerful. Thank you all for being with us. Oh, gosh, there's 15 minutes left.
Well,
hey,
now what?
It's the round table on the
what
round table. Alan Shartok is here. Dave Gustina, associate editor of the Times Union. Mike Spain as well. Well, we can go on down the list and talk about smog in China.
Oh,
now, this is actually an interesting story. It's a real problem in China and India, and it's much worse there than it is here. But it ain't all that great here as well. We're talking about an article that was, we have it from CNBC.com. I think it was in several places.
New York Times.
I read it in the Times.
Yeah.
Basically, outdoor air pollution contributed to 1.2 million premature deaths in China in 2010. That's nearly 40% of the global total. China, obviously, rapid growth. And what does this say about where we're going as a world?
Well, what does it say about different systems of government to me? I mean, here's an idea. You know, the first thing that I think of is the leaders in China wanted to industrialize, wanted to compete with the United States, wanted to have a society that really was the biggest economy after the United States in the world, and something quite shortly will be the biggest. And they were willing to let certain things go. Guess what? So were we during the Industrial Revolution. That's the whole point. Then we had the ability to say, hey, we got to rein some of this stuff in. And we are, and we're going to do more.
Well, the problem is, though, that if we're trying to rein it in and we're trying to, you know, control pollution and put stricter air controls in place, it's not going to benefit. It's not going to be effective if other countries are
this is true.
You know, kind of.
Well, that's right. But it will be better than if we didn't do that. And of course, we can't be too hypocritical and remember and forget that we didn't sign the Kyoto.
Right.
But isn't that the whole issue with Kyoto? In other words, the standards are much different for countries that are, you know, so-called developing, whereas our prices and our manufacturing prices go through the roof because we are adhering to strict, you know, standards, the latest technology to reduce emissions and reduce some of this pollution.
Well, I would point out that there were these 1.5 million premature deaths in China, that this country, you can see the sky. And you don't have the same kind of smog. Now, it might make a good point. It'll float over here one way or another and will be affected by it. And clearly it is a one-world problem. Nevertheless, that doesn't excuse us from doing everything in our power to make it better. And we're not doing enough.
What was interesting to me is in the New York Times article on this, literally two graphs over, was an article on the chief climate analyst in the U.S. Stepping away, and because he wanted to have larger targets to
hit.
Ticked
off. Yeah.
He's ticked off. The idea that whatever we're doing, it's still not enough.
Yep.
Well, it's easier for us to do it because we've already achieved.
And that's their argument.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Iran is making the same argument. Korea is making the same argument that they should have A-bombs because we have them. And, you know, yeah. And why are we and who are we to tell them not to have them?
But I mean, isn't this part of the problem that the widget that costs $3 to make here costs 20 cents there? And part of that is because
they can manufacture less expensively because they don't have to have pollution controls on their smokestacks or whatever.
Yeah. Not to mention, we don't have one environmental solution. You know, it seems like it's a combination of things. And I recently read an article that says, you know, literally, if we wanted to solve this problem, if we could, it would come from some new type of invention.
Well, China is leading in the development of mass transit. They have tremendously successful modern railways that connect their cities. Sure. You know, they go the equivalent of New York to Chicago in 3.5 hours on these high-speed trains. That cuts down on pollution. They are leading in the They're taking a lead role and putting a lot of resource into the development of electric cars and the manufacture of electric cars. And of course, that has its own pollution issues with the batteries, et cetera. But, you know, so over time, they do have the resources to at least make a big impact on this.
You're listening to The Roundtable on The Roundtable on WAMC. He's Mike Spain. He's the associate editor of The Times Union, along here with Alan Shartok and David Gustina. We'll be back after a short break. That's nice bumper music
we have here.
Mike Spain banging his head on the wall as we go back from break here on the Roundtable on the Roundtable with Mike Spain, associate editor of the Times Union, WAMC's Grand Poobah, Alan Shartok, and our Morning Edition and weather alarmist Dave Gustina is here with us on the Roundtable. So,
danger.
We play every now and then, we play Siena College basketball coach roulette, and we have done it again. And, you know, this is something we talked about yesterday briefly on Vox Pop. Alan and I discussed this with Keith Strudler. And that's the, you know, the pay of some of these college coaches. It's come into question. And Dave Gustina, I'll let you set this up.
Well, you got a new basketball coach, apparently, Jimmy Patsos. I believe, Mike, you mentioned the former coach was paid over $400,000.
Right, Fran McCaffrey, who was the coach previous to the current, the coach who was just fired at Siena, and he went to Iowa, I believe, was making, I think, seven-figure package.
So
there's a lot of money being paid to college, successful college.
So I know nothing about this stuff, so I wanted to ask you all questions, particularly.
Hang on, let's just tape that, and
Big Ray, because I just wanted to know, does the coach make the difference, or do the players make the difference?
No, I think the coach makes the difference. And I'll tell you why. Back in the 90s, they had a coach who had a losing season, Bob Beyer, and then they brought in the coach who went to Georgia.
Good old
Yes, I remember him.
Name will pop in my head. But anyway, they and he had the same team. He had the same team that was the losing team, and he took him to the NCAA with that same team.
A year
and didn't
later.
That happen with the Knicks also? Didn't the Knicks start to win after the coach?
No, they were winning beforehand. Yeah, you know, I think that in college, coach makes more of a difference with recruiting.
I was going to say,
and down the road,
recruiting
is important. And so I think there can be a case made saying, get the most coach you can afford because it improves the visibility of your program.
Right, but then players want to come to where they're going to be coached by a great coach, too.
Right, and it's chicken egg. But what's the I guess the rationale for a small college like Siena College to be paying, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars to lure a coach that's successful elsewhere to their program. I mean, what's
the
value?
You said it earlier. They have been to the big dance.
They have.
And so they're always on the periphery. And so I think the difference here is if the image is there, the better players go, the more it's a cycle. And the more often they get to the big dance, and then it just gets better and better.
But what's the overall return on investment when you do it? Not just getting to the NCAA and winning some games, but what's the benefit to the college? And that's an interesting
question.
Well,
I wonder how much alumni factors into this. They love the sporting programs. Absolutely. They support them.
It's wrong, but they do.
They do. Yeah. You often see college presidents come in and improve their sports programs right away because of the dollars that will flow in.
That's why the University at Albany years ago went to Division I in many of their big sports.
And it was painful at times.
And it was. And look at now. They've been to the NCAA a few times. I can remember reading that back in when Doug Flutie, you know, the great football quarterback, was at Boston College. They got about
Speaking of Hail Mary. 6,000
applicants a year typically at Boston College. And the year he won the Heisman Trophy, it ballooned to 16,000. That lets a college be more selective and have more diversity in who they pick. It elevates the, you know, when you can pick from that size number, you know, it lets you elevate the whole university and its image, and you get more applicants, you can attract more faculty, you can, you know, begin the chain of alumni. Charge more on the tuition, sure. It's an economic boon for
it's a
college.
It's a win-win. So we're all on board.
That's
then.
That's not so win-win when you charge more on the tuition.
The negative side is, what about the money for education? The mission of the colleges.
Well, if they get more students who can pay more tuition.
Well, yes, but then there are some who can't, you see.
But then they can have more. If they're getting more money from alums, they'll have more scholarship money.
I mean, look, these huge colleges that are perennial, you know, Final Four, Elite Eight, Duke and whatnot, they wouldn't do this if it wasn't worth it. And they do it every year, and they sink millions into this.
Well, they get big television contracts.
Well, they do. But Siena, you know, I don't know if Siena gets as far as a contract goes, but you see them on TV. They have a big program, and people around here know it's a pretty big program. Same with UAlbany.
Yep. And they say this new coach, Jimmy Patsos, has a mercurial,
personality. Our Ian Pritchett was talking about this earlier.
One season.
How will this fly at the Catholic institution?
He's going to fill the stands.
I don't know what Father Kevin is going to think about that.
Yeah.
You know, if he's
if there's a chair flying onto this.
Well, perhaps he'll tweet us. I mean, you never know.
Well, but then there, just the other day, wasn't there some coach, some buffoon yelling anti-gay slurs from the sideline?
We saw the headline, and I haven't seen the whole story.
Yeah, well, I read that story.
Right, but
why don't you tell us about
it? It wasn't good.
It's problematic.
With a fiery personality, and apparently likable, this Patsos coach, but... Could be some interesting behavior.
Just to be clear, he hasn't made any.
No,
he
Patsos
didn't.
Is
no,
not
he
the
didn't
guy.
Do that.
No, no,
but
he's
some other guy.
He's faced a few, almost being thrown out of games. One game, he climbed up into the stands and sat next to some of the patrons, you know, because he was otherwise going to probably be thrown out of the game.
So he's fun.
So he is funny. He's more humorous.
Didn't Bobby Knight used to do
Bobby,
things like that?
Well, Bobby Knight abusive. Used to throw. Oh, yeah. He used to get really mad.
This fellow isn't reported to be abusive. He's more flamboyant.
Yeah.
And
colorful. I like flamboyant colorful. That's good.
And maybe that's...
We need a little Harlem Globetrotters motif going on.
A little excitement. Paul Hewitt was the coach that came in after Bob Beyer and brought them to the NCAA.
How did you know? Did you look that up?
No, I didn't look it up. It takes time for names to pop in.
You know my theory. My theory is like the 42nd Street Library used to go in, fill out a little piece of paper. They'd put in a pneumatic tube. The pneumatic tube would go upstairs. They would wait a while. Then they would send the book down on the elevator. Then they'd put your number up on the... up on the big board, and you would go and get your book. That's my memory. And obviously here, same thing. You put a request in 20 minutes ago, you finally got your answer.
It did. It came. I knew it would come.
Get it now, Ray?
I got it. And we've ended on a strange, surreal note here. And I want to thank Mike Spain, the associate editor of the Times Union, for being here. What's coming tomorrow? Can you give us a preview?
Well, you know, we're going to continue.
More Malcolm.
I think there's going to be more Malcolm.
All right, Malcolm in the middle.
More than you want to know.
Alan Shartok, what's on your docket for today?
Oh, I have a full day. I got up at 3:30, and I'll be going with my tax man to dinner tonight.
Oh, that's exciting.
Oy vey.
Can you write that off is the question. Dave Gustina, what do you have? Anything to say?
There's some weather maps I got to check out. I'm sure there's some alarming things happening.
Dave Gustina, of course, is our weather alarmist. And I want to thank you for listening to this. If you want to join in and send us an email about it, well, go right ahead. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can hit our webpage and make a comment there, or our Facebook page, or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Thanks so much for being here.
Lucky
it's all the time
you.
We have for Alan, David, Mike. We'll keep the conversation going online. All right, Mr. Hopper.
Wilson Bakula.
And away we go.
Hey.